Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. Vice President flies to Ukraine. South Korea's president slams the crew of a capsized ferry. The Boston Marathon, site of a previous terrorist bombing, gets underway today. A prominent Burmese journalist dies. That's all ahead on International Edition. I'm Dave DeForest. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is on his way to Ukraine for talks with acting president and prime minister there. White House officials say Biden will discuss the international community's efforts to help Ukraine move forward on constitutional reform, as well as plans for the upcoming presidential election on May 25th. The talks will also focus on the situation in eastern Ukraine, where an Easter Sunday truce barely lasted a few hours before it was shattered by a gunfight at a checkpoint in the pro-Russian city of Slavyansk. Three people were killed. VOA's Michael Bowman has more.
Russian and Ukrainian officials traded accusations of responsibility for the shootout and the worsening chaos engulfing eastern Ukraine. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk spoke on NBC's Meet the Press television program broadcast in the United States.
President Putin has a dream to restore the Soviet Union. And every day he goes further and further. And God knows where is the final destination.
The Prime Minister demanded Moscow adopt a hands-off policy towards his country.
They have their own country. We have our own country. So if Russia pulls back, we will have Ukraine as one united, territorially integral, sovereign and independent state.
Russia's ambassador in Washington, Sergei Kislyak, says Moscow's only goal is to protect ethnic Russians in Ukraine. The ambassador appeared on Fox News Sunday.
We just want the Ukrainians to find a way of a dialogue, a new constitution that would help them to live in a country that is democratic, that supports the rights of all the ethnic groups, including certainly Russians.
Kislyak said Russia remains committed to last week's international accord that called for disarming militants in eastern Ukraine. Even before Sunday's shootout, U.S. President Barack Obama said he was not sure the deal would work.
My hope is that we actually do see follow-through over the next several days, but I don't think, given past performance, that we can count on that, and we have to be prepared to potentially respond to what continue to be efforts of interference by the Russians in eastern and southern Ukraine.
Some U.S. lawmakers are urging the administration to take additional steps to pressure Russia. Appearing on NBC, Republican Senator Bob Corker said U.S. sanctions have had no effect on Moscow.
To me, unless they immediately begin moving the 40,000 troops on the border, which are intimidating people in Ukraine, unless they begin immediately moving them away, I really do believe we should be sanctioning some of the companies in the energy sector, Gazprom and others. I think we should hit some of the large banks there. And certainly we should beef up our security relationships with Ukraine.
The Obama administration has ruled out lethal military assistance to Kyiv and said it stands ready to expand existing sanctions against Russia and order new ones.
That was VOA's Michael Bowman. There is a strong historical religious connection between Russia and Ukraine, but what role is religion playing in the current conflict? Michael Eccles in Moscow has this report.
From the outset, clergy played a part in the demonstrations in Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine. As Professor Andrei Zubov, an expert on the history of religions, points out, priests of different confessions, different Orthodox groups, Unitarian, Greek Catholics, everyone was together, Zubov says. While church leaders of all faiths in Ukraine appear to support the new political leadership in Kyiv, the Russian clergy are keeping silent about recent events. Alexander Soldatov is a Russian journalist who covers religion. The Russian Orthodox Church has yet to take a stance on Ukraine, Soldatov says. They have not even called for a truce during Easter, he added. The current conflict in Ukraine may be causing a schism between the Russian Orthodox Church and its Ukrainian affiliate. The Russian Orthodox Church, which has close ties to the Russian government, would not comment for this report. Again, Professor Zubov. If they come out in support of President Putin, their Ukrainian chapter could break off, Zubov says. If they support Ukraine, it would cause big problems with the Russian presidential administration, he continued. About 40% of Orthodox believers in Ukraine are Russian Orthodox. Zubov and Soldatov say Russian Patriarch Kirill is at odds with President Putin over the conflict. As evidence, they cite Kirill's absence from Putin's March 18th Crimea address in the Kremlin. But Ukrainian Orthodox priest Yakov Krotov dismisses that idea. Krotov says that officially the church is completely behind Putin and that the rumors about Patriarch Kirill and Putin are just rumors. Krotov thinks Patriarch Kirill is hedging his bets politically and called his silence meaningless. Soldatov also pointed out that whereas the clergy was active in the Kyiv demonstrations, it is nowhere to be seen in the pro-Russian protests in eastern Ukraine. While there were numerous priests of all confessions at the Maidan Square in Kyiv, Soldatov says, none are standing on the barricades surrounding the administrative buildings in Lugansk or Donetsk.
Michael Eccles reporting from Moscow. This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
Start your days with VOA's Daybreak Asia.
Daybreak Asia.
While Asia slept the night before, we've been hard at work gathering the news and talking with the newsmakers so you'll have the news you need to know for the day ahead. Pushing yesterday's stories forward and getting Washington's take on what's going on across the region, the Daybreak Asia team brings you the unique, where other media are merely repeating what you already know. Get a fresh perspective to begin your day, starting at 22 hours Universal Time, Monday through Friday, here on The Voice of America.
South Korea's president says the actions of the captain and the crew of the ferry that capsized last week with 476 people aboard were, in her words, like murder. Park Geun-hye said today their behavior was, in her words, incomprehensible and unacceptable. The captain, the third mate, and one other crew member were arrested on Saturday on charges of deserting their passengers as the ferry was sinking. Prosecutors say four more crew members, two first mates, one second mate, and an engineer have been detained on allegations of failing to protect passengers. Divers have pulled more than dozens of bodies from the sunken boat, but many more are still unaccounted for. Most of the victims were high school students. A memorial service for many of the victims is planned on Wednesday in Ansan, South Korea, home to many of the students on board. Some 36,000 runners from 70 countries are taking part today in the 118th Boston Marathon. Security is tight at the event following last year's bombings near the finish line that killed three and wounded more than 260. VOA's Victor Beatty reports an estimated 1 million people are expected to line the 42.2-kilometer route from the downtown, from the town, of Hoptinkin East to Boston's Boylston Street.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick says heightened security will include more uniformed and plainclothes police scattered throughout the race's route, as well as a ban on backpacks and large containers near the finish line, scene of last year's deadly bombings. Appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation Sunday, Patrick was asked how safe he expects the race to be.
Very safe. Somebody said it may be the safest place in America tomorrow. But I will say that we've tried to strike a balance between enhanced security and preserving the family feel of this day. One commentator, a friend of ours, Mike Barnicle, described the marathon as a 26.2-mile-long block party. And there are no strangers here. So we want to maintain that spirit, but also have considerably more rigor because of the attention that the marathon got last year, the tragedy that that ensued, and the demands we think that are quite reasonable for enhanced preparation for this year.
Patrick says there have been no known pre-race threats that would cause concern. Last Tuesday, following a memorial service marking the one-year anniversary of last year's marathon tragedy, police arrested a man with a backpack near the finish line. It contained a rice cooker and was deemed safe. On April 15, 2013, two pressure cooker devices allegedly hidden in backpacks by two brothers of Chechen descent, 26-year-old Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his 20-year-old brother Johar, detonated, sending metal fragments through a crowd of bystanders near the finish line on Boylston Street. Several people lost limbs. The blasts set off a multi-day manhunt that ended with Tamerlan Tsarnaev dead from a shootout with police and Johar being arrested in a Boston suburb. He is due to go on trial in November on 30 federal charges and could face the death penalty. He has pleaded not guilty to the charges. Scott Kennedy, one of the marathon runners, was asked Sunday why he's running today.
Just to show the terrorists that they can't win. I saw a picture a few weeks ago that said we need to take our finish line back, and that's what I think 36,000 people are going to do tomorrow, is take the finish line back.
Canadian runner Mark Rush says the bad guys are not going to take this race away. British runner Mark Hazelhurst says everyone is aware of what happened last year, and he says people want to turn out to run, to celebrate running and celebrate the city of Boston. For the top men and women competitors, including the 2013 winners, Lalisa Desisa of Ethiopia for the men and Rita Jeptu of Kenya for the women, the focus will be on the race. Another runner will be Lukman Faili, the Iraqi ambassador to Washington, who says he's taking part to show solidarity with Americans. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Candidates can begin registering today for Syria's presidential election, which the country's parliament speaker says will take place June 3rd. The vote announced today will give President Bashar al-Assad the chance to win a third seven-year term in office. Mr. Assad has been battling rebels in a conflict that began as peaceful protests in March of 2011 and quickly grew into a civil war that has killed more than 150,000 people. Another 2.6 million people have fled Syria to surrounding countries, and the crisis has displaced more than 6.5 million people within Syria. Win Tin, a prominent journalist and the co-founder of the pro-democracy opposition in Burma, also known as Myanmar, has died at the age of 84. National League for Democracy officials said Win Tin died today. The former newspaper editor founded the National League for Democracy with Aung San Suu Kyi. Win Tin became Burma's longest-serving political prisoner after challenging military rule by establishing the NLD. In 1989, Win Tin was sent to prison while Aung San Suu Kyi was placed under house arrest. At times, he was held in a cell designed for military dogs, was not provided any bedding, and was deprived of food and water for long periods of time. He was freed in 2008 and continued to work with the NLD, calling on the military to relinquish power. He continued to wear his blue prison shirt after his release as a sign of protest against military rule. Islamic extremists are claiming responsibility for a bombing in Nigeria's capital Abuja that left 75 people dead last Monday. In a video message, Abubakar Shekau is the leader of Boko Haram, taunted authorities and claimed to be living somewhere in the capital. Meanwhile, Nigerian officials searched over the weekend for 85 schoolgirls abducted from the northeastern town of Chibok. Saturday, officials said 44 other girls have escaped from kidnappers who seized them at a secondary school. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
No one has claimed responsibility for the kidnappings, but it is widely believed they were taken by Boko Haram, an Islamist insurgent group that has killed thousands of people in the past 4.5 years, including scores of schoolchildren. In the past, female students have been spared by militants who say girls should go home and marry in accordance with their own version of Islamic law. But Boko Haram has also been known to kidnap girls and women, forcing them to be their wives. Northern women say they are angry at the kidnappers and at the security forces. Marianne Abubakar is a president of the Peace, Revival and Reconciliation Foundation of Nigeria.
If care is not taken, definitely all the mothers of Nigeria will rally out. Definitely. Please, we are now pleading. We are now pleading.
The Nigerian military says it is making ongoing frantic efforts to rescue the girls, and authorities have promised to use every resource available to help. Authorities say vigilante groups and hunters are also searching the forest, where insurgents are believed to be hiding out. Kashim Shettima, the governor of Borno State, where the girls were abducted, has offered a $300,000 reward for any information leading to their rescue. But Pastor Julie Dauda in the northern city of Kaduna says it's not enough.
They should double their effort and make sure that something is done immediately. Lest they may be thinking their children are safe, it may turn to be up to their children tomorrow.
Last month, schools in Borno, one of the three northeastern states that have been under emergency rule for a year, closed after dozens of children were shot or burnt to death. Despite the shutdown, the girls abducted from Chibok reportedly turned up to take their exams. Ayuba Tula, the spokesperson for the African Youth Corps in Nigeria, says the attacks on the schools are destroying northern parents' chances of educating their children.
With the rate at which things are going, everybody is so scared, you know. Nobody will like to give birth to his own child. At the end of the day, you don't even know the whereabouts of the child. You don't even know whether the child is killed. You don't even know whether the child is being molested, you know.
Tula says armed guards should surround all schools in Nigeria. Boko Haram means Western education is sinful in the Hausa language, and the group says children should be forbidden to study anything but the Quran. Islamic scholars in Nigeria say the group is criminal in its actions and ideology, not Muslim. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
A member of Somalia's parliament has been killed by a car bomb in Mogadishu. Isaac Mohamed Ibrahim was killed when a bomb concealed in his vehicle exploded in the capital's Hamar Wain district. Another lawmaker, Mohamed Abdi, was wounded in the attack. The attack and casualties were confirmed by the Somali Prime Minister's office. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. There was a time when Muslims and Christians in the Central African Republic lived in harmony. But in recent times, sectarian strife has left many dead and hundreds of thousands displaced. After a coup last year, the country slipped into chaos. France has sent about 2,000 troops, and the African Union peacekeeping force says it now has about 5,000 forces in the country after the departure of Chadian troops. And last week, the Security Council unanimously approved a nearly 12,000-strong UN peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. For some analysis of the situation in the CAR, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He said the country has fallen into chaos and might not recover without significant international help.
Unfortunately, some of the attention that brought the intervention at the end of last year by the French forces and some African forces was also a misdiagnosis of the problem. There was a lot of talk of genocide that got the headlines, but it didn't get the right combination of forces in there. So currently in the country, there are about a little less than 6,000 African Union forces and about a little less than 2,000 French forces. Recently, the UN Security Council voted unanimously to turn this all into a UN peacekeeping mission, but the mission won't deploy until September of this year. And at which point, if you're going to deploy in September of this year, it's not a peacekeeping mission, it's a burial detail.
What's going to happen in the meantime, between now and then? Do you see concerted efforts and effective efforts on the ground at all?
Well, the presence of the French and African forces, primarily in the capital of Bangui, although it hasn't stopped all the violence, has at least put some sort of a lid on it. But they've not yet deployed to the rest of the country, and that's where a lot of what this low-level, localized violence is taking place, where the Muslim population primarily is being victimized, not exclusively, but primarily. And there's an area where about 19,000 Muslims are entirely surrounded and isolated right now, and the French have actually raised proposals of evacuating them. I'm sort of torn on that. On one hand, you want to save their lives, On the other hand, that sort of hands those carrying out violence the victory they sought, which is to clear these people out. So it's a very difficult choice.
What is the role of Chad and other neighbors in either exacerbating the situation or perhaps trying to help diffuse this crisis?
Recently, the Chadian forces came under criticism by a number of people, both Central Africans and others, for having favored one side or the other. Primarily, the accusation was they favored the Muslim population because of ethnic and religious similarities and the fact that they had helped bring to power the Seleka movement last year. And so, kind of stung by the criticism, Chad recently decided to pull out, and this past week completed its pullout officially from the Central African Republic. And the real question is now, if this chaos, this vacuum, this violence continues, some of the neighboring countries may be tempted to, if not carve out territory, certainly advance their own interests rather than leave a vacuum on their doorsteps.
Do you see this country splitting, whereby the bulk of the Muslim population will seek shelter elsewhere because they are the ones who are primarily victimized?
There's a danger. I don't see a great probability, but a danger. The former warlord who'd seized power and been president and now is in exile, Michel Chitodia, has made statements about carving out a separate Muslim state. But this is a country really that, like South Sudan, needs this conversation about what it means to be a country. It never has had that luck. Its independence leader, Bartholomew Baganda, died shortly before independence. And since then, it's had a succession, counting the current president, of 8 heads of state. And of the 8, only one was elected. The rest seized power violently. State institutions were never built. The country has been plundered mercilessly. And all the resources this country has, potentially, agriculture, minerals, potentially hydrocarbons, uranium, none of which has been developed to the benefit of the people.
J. Peter Pham is director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He spoke with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. For more on their discussion, go to voanews.com. Look under the Programs tab for Encounter. This is International Edition. I'm Dave DeForest.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With the landing of
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
The famed Sherpa guides of Nepal are considering a strike following a massive avalanche on Mount Everest last week that killed 13 guides. The Sherpas are seeking better pay and welfare provisions. 3 of them were hospitalized after the avalanche Friday, and 3 more are presumed dead. When the avalanche struck, the guides were fixing ropes and cracking snow and ice to carve a route for foreign climbers waiting in camps below. The accident has brought attention to the guides' dangerous work. Nepal has announced a payment of about $400 to the families of dead Sherpas. The guides are seeking increased compensation for the families. They make up to about $5,000 per season for their grueling work for clients who can spend tens of thousands of dollars in preparation for the ascent. Nepalese officials say a work stoppage could seriously disrupt the peak climbing season that begins in May. Well, that's about it for us today on International Edition. Thank you for tuning in. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis of global events 24 hours a day on our website. Check it out. It's voanews.com. Sitting in again today for Susan Yockey, I'm Dave DeForest in Washington. Have a good day. This is Today in History. According to mythology, April 21st, 753 BC is the day on which Romulus and Remus founded the city of Rome at the site where they had been suckled as infants by a wolf. Actually, archaeologists believe the area had been inhabited by people long before the traditional founding date. In 1509, Henry VIII became King of England. Henry is known for having six wives during his lifetime and for separating the Church of England from the Roman Catholic Church in order to obtain a divorce. In 1782, the city of Ratanakosin, now known as Bangkok, was founded. In 1836, Texian Army General Sam Houston defeated Mexican troops in the Battle of San Jacinto, the concluding battle in the War for Texas Independence. Santa Anna, the president of Mexico, was captured the next day and held as a prisoner of war. In 1863, Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith, declared to his friends that his mission in life was to be an emissary of God. His teaching about the unity of religions was controversial, and he was exiled from his native Persia. The Baha'i religion claims more than 4 million adherents worldwide. On this day in 1918, in the skies over France, Manfred von Richthofen, the notorious German flying ace known as the Red Baron, was killed by Allied ground fire. Richthofen was the son of a Prussian nobleman. He joined the German Air Force in 1915 during World War I and is credited with downing 80 aircraft. In 1930, a fire at an Ohio prison killed 320 inmates, some of whom were burned to death locked in their cells. It is one of the worst prison disasters in American history. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After a meeting in Geneva over the crisis in Ukraine, precipitated by the attempted annexation of Crimea by Russia last month, the massing of tens of thousands of Russian troops on Ukraine's eastern border, and by Russia's support for armed anti-government protesters in several Ukrainian cities, Russia, Ukraine, the United States, and the European Union have reached an initial agreement aimed at de-escalating tensions. Speaking at a news conference April 17th in company with European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry outlined several concrete steps agreed to by the parties with the goal of calming the situation and restoring security for all Ukrainians. One is that all sides must refrain from any violence, intimidation, or provocative actions. In addition, Secretary Kerry said all participants strongly condemned and rejected all expressions of extremism, racism, and religious intolerance, including anti-Semitism. Another step is that illegal armed groups must be disarmed and all illegally seized buildings must be returned to legitimate owners. Third, amnesty will be granted to those who have left buildings and other public places and surrender weapons, with the exception of those found guilty of capital crimes. The parties also agreed that the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Special Monitoring Mission should play a leading role in assisting Ukrainian authorities and local communities in the immediate implementation of these de-escalation measures. The U.S., EU, and Russia commit to support this mission, including by providing monitors. Secretary Kerry noted that in the meeting, the Ukrainian representative, Foreign Minister Andrei Deschitsia, briefed the others on the extensive and inclusive constitutional reform process currently underway in Ukraine, geared to address all of the legitimate grievances. Secretary of State Kerry called the agreement a good day's work, but urged that it be translated immediately into actions. He said he made it clear to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov that unless there is immediate progress on implementing the agreement, further costs in terms of additional sanctions would be imposed on Russia. The Ukrainian government has exhibited extraordinary patience and fortitude in the face of the enormous challenges and pressure, said Secretary Kerry. The Ukrainian people now deserve a right to choose their own future. The international community remains firmly by their side as they travel the difficult democratic path to prosperity and to peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.